Welcome to the Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings. I'm your host, Amanda Busick. Our podcast aims to introduce you to the inspirational women who showcase their talents and leaderships across the automotive and motorsports worlds. And even when I have my own moments of doubt and uncertainty, it is with this community of women that I am reminded of what is possible. Thank you all for sharing in this space of authenticity with us. Here we go. In her current role as Vice President of Vehicle Connected Services and Program Management Office at Nissan, Sonia Reif has spent her professional career in an industry she loves. With a passion for racing and an engineering background, Sonia kicked off her automotive journey when GM held a career fair at North Carolina State University. Next came a move to work at the Proving Grounds in Michigan, an MBA from the University of Michigan, followed by a now 20-plus year career at Nissan. We talked to the Nashville resident on the evolution in the car industry during her tenure, key moments in her career, and if she feels content with where she is now. I think you will learn quickly that as impressive of a resume Sonia currently holds, the 2020 delegate from the 100 leading women in the North American auto industry is just getting started. Your Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings, starts now. Welcome to the Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings. This week's guest is Sonia Reif. She is the Vice President of Vehicle Connected Services and Program Management Office at Nissan. And Sonia, you started at Nissan in 2001, and I guess this would be rounding into 21 years later. Could you have imagined at this point when starting that you would still be with the same company?
Oh my goodness, 20 years. You know, when you say it, it feels more real. So I try not to use that time period too long because it makes me feel older than I want to be. Staying with the company that long, you know, I think I imagined, but I never imagined what 20 years actually meant. And I would have never, ever pictured where I am today, what I've done to today. It honestly, thinking back at what it felt like in year one to now year 21 is totally different.
Well, I think what's so neat about that is you look at kind of just the trends in the marketplace and being, it's almost a rite of passage to go from company to company these days. What are the benefits with being with one brand or one company for so long?
I think especially as you move on in your career and what you want to contribute to your company becomes more about the brand, the product, the vision, the strategy. And, you know, honestly, the longer that you've been with the company, the more that you understand their culture, their history, their capabilities, the strengths, I think the better that you're able to contribute to really driving the future for that company. And you're so invested in it, you know, from growing up within it. I think that's really the benefit of the time that you've spent.
I can't imagine if you look over the last 20 years of the automotive industry, there's been a lot of changes and evolutions of things. And I'm sure just the forward trajectory is that unknown as well. When you go back to the early years at Nissan, talk about that phase of your career.
You know, the early years were very much, they were eye-opening. They were a time period. First of all, you know, I joined automotive really with this passion for cars. I had gotten into a little bit of racing in college. My first job was at the Proving Grounds. It was very physical, you know, physically engaged with cars, with that driving experience. And that's what was my focus. And so as I got into the actual industry and I really, first of all, understood just how much is behind that the product itself is that culmination of years of thoughtfulness in design and validation. It was very eye-opening in the beginning. And honestly, it's overwhelming almost in the magnitude of what has to happen to deliver a product. So you really spend your first many years just learning. So you're doing a specific job, but in the scope of the whole product development is pretty small. So you're always knowing and learning and sort of getting better by understanding, you know, the full context that you're working in. And honestly, every time you think you understand, it gets one step bigger. You realize, well, it's not just product development. There's this whole marketing and dealer side. There's this whole upfront, you know, design and industrialization strategy. And it just continues to grow. That's how I remember the first years, is continually being in awe of all there was to learn and thinking, I don't know how anybody could run this kind of company.
So I do want to break into, because I had seen this in an article about you, but I find it just the stepping into the grounds of it, but traveling to Japan as a female and getting like breaking the doors open in your career, that just had to have been incredible.
I don't know if it was at the moment. At the moment, there were so many things at once. I remember going to Japan for the first time. the guy that sat next to me at work had like, he'd gotten a piece of paper and he'd written all the things like, okay, you take this train, and then he drew a little map and you need to go down the stairs and out the, you know, out of the train station and cross the road. And that, that experience, the whole experience of Japan that was so exciting and intimidating was one thing, but you added on top of that a real cultural difference. Not only the Japan culture, but then there is a different expectations of gender roles. You know, what I was and expected to be in the US was a little bit different perhaps than what people expected I was and would be in Japan, and being sensitive to that and starting to navigate that in a way that was where I was still respectful of myself while respectful of the culture was very much, especially for a young woman, was quite eye-opening, and I learned a lot. And I think that navigating that early on gave me a lot of confidence later. And you know, if you can get through, first of all, the trip from the airport to the technical center, you have already made a huge achievement. If you can then go into the technical center and get people to work with you in a way that's productive, that was actually the biggest win of the whole thing. And it took time. It took patience and sitting and waiting and kind of building trust. It was great though. At the end, I learned so much from that I use today.
I felt a little bit of panic about the hand-drawn map, because I, you know, traveling internationally and with the luxury of having Google Maps, and you still feel stressed out, right? So looking back on those kind of experiences, is there part of it that you can say you learned about yourself that you still use today?
The hand-drawn map. So I am an over-preparer. I prepare for everything. So I always had directions and maps. Like, I like to think about everything in advance. And so the idea of going by myself, like I wasn't even traveling with anybody, by myself to a foreign country where I can't read the signs, can't speak the language, and I literally have this guy's piece of paper. And he was a nice guy, but he wasn't the first guy that you would go to, like, for instructions, right? And I thought, and it was so overwhelming, and I was so scared. And I always took after that, like, you can be nervous, you can be scared, but you can do many things. And so that was really, it was life-changing. It just gave me this confidence that being frightened is okay, being uncomfortable is okay, but you can do a lot more than you think you can. You just have to, honestly, you just have to start. You just have to start. So I've always kind of taken that, like, well, you can back out at any moment, just start. And then we'll make decisions.
I want to go back to a little bit of the start for you. You did study mechanical engineering at NC State. I have to imagine that was as male dominated as sometimes the automotive world can be. What led you to pursue that degree at North Carolina State University?
I think it was the only thing I thought I might be good at. I knew that math and science was where I was strongest. And I, through high school, didn't have a good sense of what I was going to do with that. I knew, you know, you always get quickly the sense of where you're more comfortable and where you seem to be performing better and kind of what you enjoy. But I really couldn't imagine what that meant. What should I do with these things? And I happen, as many things go in life, I happened to take an AP physics class. And I I remember making, it's a Rube Goldberg machine. So if you don't know what this is, it's like where you start a series of reactions that at the end accomplishes something else, right? And it goes through many transitions, the energy, right? Transitions many times in many forms. And I loved that. And I remember thinking, can I do something like this? This is fun. This is that culmination of, you know, physical hands-on producing something and beforehand using a conceptual, using my mind to imagine and to create and bringing all of that together excites me. And somehow I made the connection probably with that teacher who is one of those folks in your life that's instrumental in kind of giving you just the nudge in the right direction was, oh, engineering, this is kind of what they do. Okay, perfect, done. And again, I can sometimes be quite single-minded. So I was like, that sounds great. I'm going to be an engineer. I'm here in North Carolina, NC State's down the road, done. and didn't look back and really did enjoy. I was always, you know, continually that decision was reaffirmed through school and then getting into racing, again, falling into it by happenstance and then marrying up engineering with automotive and one, you know, lucky moment upon another.
How many women were in engineering?
I believe, you know, I remember a couple of women along the way. You know, most classes of 100 would probably be 5 or less women.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's a number of reasons. I do think we are more aware than we used to be about sort of gender expectations and the way that we treat our sons and our daughters and the way that society treats our sons and daughters. And that certainly creates expectations early on. I have no doubt of that. I do also think there are some realities of gender differences and that those do often lend people to choose different types of interests and careers. So I'm not a believer that everything should always be 50-50. I do think we should, you know, be aware of and celebrate our differences and what sometimes, you know, is more considered a more feminine or a more masculine trait or strength. But you have to remove that then by the expectations that we unnaturally perhaps introduce. So I hope, though, you know, we're still not good at it today. We still all do it. Sometimes naturally, I don't think as much intentionally, but I like to see more and more that we're having more common expectations, or at least we're encouraging more equally.
I love the awareness that's happening across the entire space about women in automotive or women in motorsports. And Nissan has a big push to that as well. Where do you feel within the company that they're really grasping on looking at the next generation and talent of women?
I think across the company, you know, actually for many years and probably because of our Japanese heritage, there has always been a real awareness of gender disparity in Nissan and how it was very apparent. And as we went into the alliance with Renault, which brought us a new culture and a new view of culture, it really challenged Nissan to look at themselves and say, you know, are we actually creating the kind of environment and culture that we're meaning to? Are we challenging forward a little bit past perhaps our heritage? And so gender challenge in Nissan actually started many, many years ago. And so I was lucky also to be a part of that in the early days. So there was a focus on and just sort of a little bit of an additional support to recognize you are a woman in a very male organization, but we see you, we appreciate you, we want to help you make this journey. And I did appreciate it was never like, it always recognized, we know it's a little bit more difficult. We know our culture hasn't transformed yet, but we're trying and we're reaching out to you. And I always found that it always just kept me like right there. Like, okay. And inviting those of us who were in and were beginning to be successful to be a part of that and to contribute to that journey. I was appreciative of that. There's a lot. The culture still hasn't moved as far as we would like. And I say hasn't moved. What am I meaning is as far as we would like. But that's not right? That's not unique to us. That's something I think we're dealing with as a larger society. But Nissan has been good about continuing to challenge and to take the feedback of the women who are here.
So back to you're finishing up mechanical engineering at NC State. Where did the idea of working in the car industry start? I know you had some racing background, autocross and the legend stuff, but when you're like, oh, this can be my job.
At the time, I was very much excited actually about being in the power industry. So my co-ops were with Carolina Power and Light. I really loved that. I loved thermodynamics. And I at a time thought that's where I'm going to be focused. And when it came time to interview, I had started at that point some autocross, was doing the Legends racing. And so when I went to all my interview list and General Motors came to campus, I was like, yeah, let's put them on the list, right? And then I did all my interviews. I went to many places, you know, okay. And then I went to the Proving Grounds in Michigan. And I was like, wow. This is a job. People actually come out here and they drive cars. Oh my gosh. Done. I'm in. Count me in. I was just enthusiastic to find that you could really take two things that you were excited about and make them into your career. And so I was sold. Not that I don't love power plants, but it's not quite the same. So the idea of really having a passion for the product at the end sold me.
And up in Michigan, you ended up adding a master's to your education path at the University of Michigan. What skills from that did you gain that prepared you for your career?
In engineering, you know, we learn a lot of very, very useful, very practical, pragmatic kind of skills about moving a product forward from a technical point of view. But it doesn't take long in a big company where you recognize that there's more than just the technical side to moving a product forward, and that the decision makers here are those that have a broader view of the business implications of decisions. And so the people that you could see that were the most influential, the most powerful in moving their ideas forward were those that had the capability to talk about something in a much broader context. And I thought, that's me. I need that skill set. So I was very lucky that Nissan was supportive. So it took a while to do it at night. But the skills that I added were definitely the ones that I needed. No one was asking me to do it at the time. I think I just recognized like that was something that was missing maybe so far in my capability. But the ability to speak in financial terms is, of course, you know, if you want to go anywhere at the end, you need to be able to do that. But also to understand some of the softer side of product, you know, development in terms of marketing it or understanding how customers perceive our product or to make the relationship back from customer expectations to technical execution. All of that was really broadened. Just my mind was broadened around those ideas, organizational health. Oh, it just is this whole bigger context to what I could contribute.
What point of this journey in your professional career did you know you had made the right decision of what you pursued?
Oh, I'm still waiting for that. I'm happy that I seem to be doing okay. Like progress continues, and I feel like that's always a good sign. Okay, this is a good choice. I still have a love for our product. I think that's a good sign. I never look today and think I wish I had chosen a different path. I don't know if at the end how this will all turn out and what will be my mark on the industry. You know, that's to me the final. That'll be the final test is, did I make a mark here in some way? But I have never doubted that this was a good direction for me.
I'll go ahead and, because this was going to be one of my questions to the end, but I'll go ahead and ask, because I think you kind of led right to it. A part of you, do you still feel restless or do you feel content?
I never feel content. Yeah. Always restless. I mean, I think that's part of any executive who is really contributing has to be restless, because if you're satisfied with where we are today, then we won't go forward. We just maintain the status quo and we will die. And in this industry, in this time period, there couldn't be anything more important than having a team of restless executives. The absolute worst thing you could have today is a team that was content or complacent, because there is no room for that in this moment. Everything is in this. We are in the revolution, right? I think during maybe an evolution, you can sort of have contentness, right? And sort of the continuous improvement, but that's not the state that we're in today. So I would hate to at all think that I was content.
What do you feel like? Because I also agree with you. I think it's so fascinating, this revolution that's happening right now. But even just in the terms of like product development, or so, it's not that many years. But what do you pinpoint as just the most drastic change from when you started to right now in the car industry?
The most drastic change has been the consumer shift from the priority of the dynamic driving experience to the priority of the emotional or intellectual experience. We used to be very focused, right? I went to the proving grounds. That was exciting. We were focused on dynamically the experience of driving a car. How does it feel? How fast does it go? How does it handle? Is it quiet? You know, that physical relationship with a vehicle was the priority. But today, while that is absolutely part of the uniqueness of the experience, the consumer focus has become much more around this area of connected autonomous. Is the vehicle now a part of my experience, of my connected experience, of all of the other experiences that I'm having in a day, rather than something which is unique and separated?
It's interesting because it's almost like the car was a tangible item that people had in their garage. And now the automobile is of me.
Yeah.
Right. It's an extension of my personality, who I am, what I represent. And I find that specifically, like even with your title, Vice President of Vehicle Connected Services, like did that role exist prior to this new evolution of the desire to connect consumer to car?
Right. Absolutely not. So when I started, there was no such thing, first of all. And in fact, we didn't even have, you see many companies today coming out with these roles specifically around the customer's experience, and they're titled, you know, Chief Customer Experience Officer, or, and everything is now this holistic view of the entire experience of owning a car. From the very beginning and what that looks like, to being in the car, to being outside of the car, to how that experience connects with my home and my life, the idea of personalization, you know, and that's a struggle, right? This, the balance between brand identity and personalization, and then you're needing people to bring those together. And connected services, you know, for a long time, that was simply like I press the SOS button in my car and at least I can communicate to someone else, right? And that was what was connected. And we didn't need like a vice president of the button, but we started to quickly realize from there. And actually, I think as the phone transformed everyone's expectations of what was possible, and start to realize, no, there's a much bigger connected experience. And it's not just connected to the internet, it's sort of connected to my life, right? Where just like your home becomes connected and your cars connect, everything is beginning to come around this very personal experience. Yeah, that's a huge, it's just a whole new area for us that we never imagined.
Are there any trends in the marketplace that you think are emerging to the next generation of buyers that we can look out for?
I think most of the trends have presented themselves already, and it's how we will finally end up manifesting those. You see, I think everyone's struggling with, and I mentioned before, sort of the balance between brand and personalization. You see OEs trying to decide if they're going to individually develop their own operating systems or they're going to go with something that's already established. I think that the what we're trying to build for a customer, we can imagine, but the best way in which to do that, we haven't yet. But we know all these trends. We want to create a driving experience that can be either exciting and dynamic and personal, or where you can, right, give that to the vehicle and it's autonomous and it's safe and it, you know, you are sort of a passenger on your own journey. Those trends are emerging. The execution of those trends is going to take some time.
I have to say, I do really enjoy being able to change the mood lighting in my car. That's not something that I knew was going to happen. So it was a pretty cool experience.
Right.
Back to, because I know you've been a part of some different, I guess, phases would be the right word in your career, R&D side, chief engineer, where you are now. Do you look at your professional growth in phases?
There certainly have been key moments of change over the career, but I never separate them. I've always seen them as an evolution, as the next natural step. So I never got to a point in the career and really pivoted over and thought, well, I'm going in the wrong direction. Let me shift over here. That said, I would not have imagined being in this role 10 years ago. I really thought, you know, I would stay in the R&D space and continue to try and expand there. But again, as you, every time I get to one place and I begin to see what's possible with that experience, I kind of reassess. Well, maybe what I thought I was doing is not it. Maybe the natural evolution, just like we talked about in that, you know, in that early physics class, where you kind of find the thing unexpectedly that is the culmination of all of your sort of your skills and experiences. I've sort of found along the way, oh, this is actually a better fit for what it turns out that I am able to do best, or what the company best, you know, gets from me. So it's always been sort of a step-by-step evolution.
And where are you with that now?
I'm ready to move to the next thing.
Is there a project that you've worked on that you are particularly proud of?
There are two things that I've done in Nissan that when somebody asked me, like, what stood out to you most, and they're quite different. One is I was the chief engineer in the US for Rogue when that segment exploded, and actually where Rogue was the best selling in the segment at the time. And we made some changes both on a quality side and on a cost side all at the same time as this was happening, that just we were able to move at a pace and with an impact that we hadn't done in the past. And I was really proud of being able to lead that team to do that. And of course, like many things, the moment was right. So we got a lot of support. And when you have a big vehicle, many things can get done quickly. But that was rewarding for me, and I think for the company as well. And the other one is totally different as a member of the R&D team. Something that we focused on a few years ago was really improving the employee perception of our quality of management. So like many companies, we use a third-party survey to sort of judge where the employees see the strengths and weaknesses of the company and of the leaders. And one where we wanted to do better, to challenge ourselves, was in this quality of management, you know, perception. And so we really, I'll say, like, we doubled down on, like, this is the focus. This is what we're going to make sure that we're doing well. And so I was able to lead that effort, and we had a dramatic improvement just over a year, and then over 2 years in the employee scores and reaction. And I was super proud of that as well.
Congratulations. Is there someone along your journey within the automotive space and in your professional career that has advised you or supported you?
Lots of people. Not necessarily one person the whole way, but I have always been very conscious of taking advice from people with more experience, with a different perspective than I have. And best is to take, advice from many different points of view. But there has always been along the way, maybe somebody that I'm talking to or listening to, whether that's mostly informal, you know, but somebody you kind of are looking at that can see you from a little bit further distance and give you some good advice. Lots of those folks along the way.
Well, I'd be remiss to say that you, while women, we can compartmentalize ourselves in our roles, your professional career is just one side of you. Your personal life is also very core to who you are, your husband, your children. He also works in automotive. How does the family support that you have built enhance your professional side of your role?
I think the family side has changed its role over that time also. You know, in the beginning, it didn't have a family side. Okay, so everything could be, you know, priority sort of on career and self. And then we made that first transition where, quite honestly, priority became the family. So as you have young children and two growing careers, and you are very much focused on making sure that stays priority one, and perhaps particularly at that time, they're taking more than they're giving. And then sort of we've come to a transition over the last few years where now the family is a part of driving this career forward. So where they're engaged in making it possible. So I think it has really transformed over time, but we have always been of a single focus, which is that our priority, our shared priority, is our health and well-being as a unit, not as individuals. So I'm always very cautious about making decisions that benefit me only, and that I'm always checking in on what's better for us as a collective unit, because honestly, that's what makes me better, right? If the unit's not healthy, I'm not going to do well anyway. So it doesn't, you know, doesn't really matter. That's still for me priority one. Nobody's going to care after I'm gone what I did for this company.
Who's going to hold your hand at the end of it all?
Which came from one of those people along the way who advised me, who's going to hold your hand at the end. And I need to be very, very conscientious that you're maintaining that relationship and that priority.
Do you feel it's harder to juggle that as women?
I do. I think that the expectations are different. And that's the first expectations that maybe society puts on us, but also that we put on ourselves. I realize that sometimes the weight of the expectations is just self-generated, that I decided that I needed to do certain things, that I decided I needed to be, you know, the first one that the school called, or the first one that I wanted those things. And, you know, I did that to myself. I do think that it's harder for women because, again, there's the two sides. Society put that a little bit and we take that. I think we're not always willing to fight back because that can come with some consequences that you have to decide if you're ready to take on, if that's your priority to fight that battle. And then again, whether it's because we're women and there's a part of our nature that wants to be, in this case, motherly or, you know, the support for our family, that's who we are, right? So I think that some good advice also I got along the way was very much just to embrace that and not to feel also to let people make me feel like that was wrong or not, you know, that I should do differently or I should fight back differently, but to embrace what made me happy.
Do you feel that there is a misconception about women who work in automotive?
I can imagine. I would not say that I know. I can imagine that there is, that perhaps we have, I don't know if it's automotive or even I would just say STEM in general or because there's two things that are happening there. I think in general, there are feelings about people in automotive, right? It's seen as an older industry, perhaps less innovative, a little bit slower. So I think you take that. And then you talk about maybe quite women that are in male dominated, you know, professions and whether that comes with some sort of, you know, preconceived notion. I got to think that that's less than it used to be because now everybody knows people.
Yeah.
You know, in the past, if you didn't know, then you have your own vision. But I think at this point, everybody knows plenty of people. And so a lot of those misconceptions are maybe going by the wayside. Automotive, though, I don't know if those ones are going by the wayside yet.
Of the accolades you've received in your career, one of those is 100 leading women in North American auto industry. How are you with praise?
Not good. Not good. I try, you know, people tell you all the time, you just got to learn to say thank you, right? You don't have to, you don't have to try to be humble or say, oh, you know, I don't deserve it, to say thank you. So I always try to remind myself, like, even if you feel really awkward and uncomfortable, just say thank you.
Today, what is the best part of your job?
Best part of my job is you're going to be like, of course it is the people that I work with. That's why I come in. That's what gives me the positive momentum, feel like you're doing the right thing and you're doing it for somebody. That's what it makes it worthwhile.
Sonia Reef on the Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings. Sonia, this is the hot lap. So if you're going to head out on a road trip, where are you going?
Beach.
Okay. What are you driving?
Guilty pleasure, QX80.
There you go. You're driving it. So who's your passenger?
My husband.
What's on the radio?
UB40.
UB40. Okay. Fantastic.
We're going to the beach with the windows down. So UB40.
That's great. Let's go. Okay. And guilty pleasure when it comes to road snacks.
Pizza combos and Twizzlers.
That's a heck of a road trip. I want to go with you guys. Just closing this Women Shifting Gears, driven by Hemmings podcast out with you. You talked about just the influence that you want to have on this industry or the mark that you hope to set. What do you want to be remembered for?
I want to be remembered for being courageous, for pushing the envelope, for being willing to do new things, for doing things even if they were uncomfortable, and for pushing other people to do the same, other women particularly to do the same.
Thank you much. Sonia Reef on the Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings.
This Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings, is a production of GS Events.